kadar tahriş veriyor.
Welcome to Trial by Wine. We take a closer look at crimes that highlight how fascinating humans can be. Schmitty, Swanee and Clarkey visit crimes and run them through their jury of three, debating both sides of the case to agree an appropriate, if totally fictitious, sentence. Please be advised, Trial by Wine may include explicit or disturbing content and will include drunken rambling. Listener discretion is advised.
All right, how are we?
Super duper.
Oh, and it's a public holiday. Isn't that nice? I was just thinking how wonderful it is to not be at work. Yeah.
It is nice to break it up because we have had the never ending summer. I mean, it has been unbelievable. It has been hot, and I mean either seriously hot or very warm. Even last Friday, it was 30 degrees, 32, I think, the day before. But the weather has finally changed. We've had some quite like 12 degree mornings, which is cold for Perth. Still been getting warmer in the afternoons, but today it's actually cold. And because it's a public holiday and it just feels cozy and it's like, oh, the seasons changed. I was outside raking leaves. I was like, finally a little bit of weather or something different around here after, you know, four and a half months, I think it's been, of like no rain, dry, hot weather. So it does feel quite nice to have a day off.
Awesome.
What are you guys up to? What are you doing today to celebrate your day off?
We got up at 5 o'clock or something and made coffees. And during COVID, we started a tradition of having a fire out by the front of the, you know, by the driveway, which is what everyone was doing in lockdown. And so we've just kept doing that. So we had a little fire out the front, did the dawn service, painted the house.
Oh, that's nice.
Or painted part of the house.
Yeah, same coat. So that's looking lovely.
Beautiful.
Just that. What about you, Schmitty?
I got up at 7:30 this morning and was madly doing my notes for this story. And then I had a friend pop in who wanted some advice because she's got a job interview tomorrow. And then she left and I went back to writing my story in a desperate bid to finish it. And I did finish it. And I thought I finished it 9 minutes before we were due to record, only to discover that I had the timing wrong and I had another 2 hours up my sleeve. So then I went up on our lovely deck, I dropped all the bistro blinds and I've been sitting up there reading a trashy romance novel. That was, I think, a very nice way to enjoy a slightly wintry, as you say, Carla, autumnal day off. And it was cold actually up there. So I also brought one of my Rinnai heaters out. So I had the heater on in there and it was just so very lovely. Yes. So there you go. And then I thought I'd better come down to my freezing cold office and meet you guys. And so here we are.
I'm glad you did.
I suppose.
You got it. Oh, it's not a mango chat. What is that?
We're not there yet. It is a mango chat.
Oh, I'm there already. I saw that.
Well, I will admit I tried very hard not to pregame, but once I discovered that I was 2 hours ahead of myself, I thought, I might have a little pirate
game
juice.
On.
Yeah, so I've had quite light pirate juices. Then I'm off that. When we get on to what we drink, I'll tell you what I'm on now, that I think everyone knows because Carla let the cat out of the bag.
I let the cats out of the bag.
But before we get there, who are we? I'm Schmitty.
I'm Swanee.
And I'm Clarkey. And together we are
Trial by Wine.
And speaking of wine, what are we drinking? Well, I'll go first. I'm drinking a mango chutney. There you go.
Surprise. I'm on a Coke Zero, but I thought I might drink a little bit later. I
would love that. I have a feeling we've got quite a lot to do today. And what about you guys? What are you drinking?
We are having a Great Northern, just a beer to start things off.
Yeah, apologies, listeners. Not Trial by Wine today. Trial by Spirits and
Beers.
It will
be later, though.
Well, given I did work so furiously on my notes, I'm going to tell our story now. Today's story. If that's all right with the two of you.
Good idea.
Get him.
and woo.
I mean, you say that, but if we were to change that plan, I reckon you would crack it because you've gone so hard to get this story ready from right now. You could storm off. So I don't want to cause that scene. Let's go.
I would never
do
that. My drama is best kept for the stage. So as opposed to in my normal life. So I'll tell you this story. Now, I can't really remember how I found it. I think I was surfing the net, as you do, trying to find something.
Oh, really? Were you, old lady?
And I know. And I really was a bit uninspired lately, which is, you know, sort of like, oh, God, what do I do? What do I find? Because you want something that's got a really good story in it, and often you come across stuff and you think, you know, boring.
I find it to be the hardest part sometimes is to find something that you can get your teeth into or, you know, we've talked about this so many times, there's part of it that's good and then it lets itself down. Sometimes you get into a crime and you think, oh, my God, this one just keeps giving. There's nothing quite like that as a gift, is there?
Well, that's what this one it turned out to be. Yes, good. Yes.
Good for you. I love it when that happens.
I started to look at, I came across some listicle or something about the oldest cold case ever solved. And I thought, oh, okay, that could be interesting. So I thought I'd have a little look into that topic.
Was it Jesus?
No. We know who murdered him.
Was it the Romans?
The Romans sentenced him, but the Romans sentenced him because the Jews gave him up to the Romans. So it was all a bit of a conspiracy, really. Anyway, I was only being silly. It's all good. Because this Kaki will tell you, Jesus wasn't real. Actually, that's a really
100%.
Amusing segue into today's story. I didn't even plan that. All right, so I actually quite specifically avoided cold cases that have been solved by DNA, and I know it's a sensational and fairly new development in crime investigation, but I started to wonder about how do you solve a case that's gone cold for decades without forensic evidence? So, you know, what would it take to actually solve it? Yeah, maybe. You know, a visitation from Jesus.
Remember people when they leak in the cupboard? Remember someone put someone in a cupboard and it started leaking?
Yes.
Yeah.
And maybe they used some water diviner.
Who was that?
Oh, stop it. Gacy,
it wasn't their wardrobe.
Yeah, put him in the wardrobe. Yeah, and then they said
that's right.
Bit of seepage.
Seepage.
So foul.
Oh.
Anyway.
Yuck.
Right. Well, on that note, I'll just cover my sources. CBSNews.com, CNN.com, Wikipedia, PhoenixNewTimes.com, Texas Monthly, Poddles.org, and the CBS News articles used information and content from a 48 hours investigation. So.
Can you tell me anything about Poddles.org? It's a very unusual source.
I don't know what it is, and I didn't actually bother to look it up, as in, you know, beyond what I'd found, but it was a very, very good sequential account with a bit more information than Wikipedia about the case. So it was a really good resource, actually. Yeah.
Thanks, Puddles.
Thank you very much, Puddles. Let's go back in the timey-wimey machine to the 60s, where we find ourselves in Edinburgh, Texas. Now, originally it was Edinburgh, but as the Americans struggle with certain pronunciations.
Why? Yeah, like what?
I literally looked up pronunciation of Edinburgh, Texas, and it said Edinburgh, and Edinburgh. I thought, okay.
Because you're so good with your Scottish accent. Not always.
Okay, the new. That's right. The H was dropped in around 1911. So previously Edinburgh, but now Edinburgh. On March the 23rd, 1960, Maria America Guerra, a student at Pam American College, was at her home, which was across from the Sacred Heart Church. It was 4:30 in the afternoon, and she was performing some afternoon ablutions in the outside bathhouse when she noticed a man watching her. He was sitting in a blue and white car, and she noticed that he had black hair.
Hang on. Did she have the door open?
No, I think she was actually just crossing to the outside. She went out to the washroom.
Right. I had visions of her sitting there and going, hang on a minute.
Why is that man staring at me? No, I think the way I picture it is she was going outside to the outside bathroom.
Right.
And she's at college at the time. Or she's just a student.
Yeah. She was 20, I think, at the time. Some early 20s around that time. Anyway, so she sees this guy and he's sitting in a blue and white car and she noticed that he had black hair and was wearing horn-rimmed glasses.
Horn-bag glasses.
It wasn't normal for her to see someone staring at her, so it sort of stood out for her, but she went about her business. After dinner, she went over to the church and she saw the same man who she'd seen earlier in his car was now sitting in the back of the church. Not thinking too much about the man in the back, she knelt at the altar and started to say the rosary. Now, I'm pretty sure there was quite a strong following in Edinburgh. It's a border town to Mexico and a large population of the populace are Hispanic and Catholic. I figure that Maria was a pretty devout Catholic because to say the rosary takes ages. As she works her way through the Apostles' Creed, well, the way it goes is you do the Apostles' Creed and I think then – so you follow the beads and you do Apostles' Creed, Our Father – so you do this first prayer and then you do, I think it's the Our Father, and you do three or something Hail Marys, and then you do another prayer, and then you do three or four Hail Marys or four Our Fathers. Like it goes on. And if you follow it, it's a it's basically the length of a necklace. So you follow it all the way around. By the end of it, you've probably done 25 prayers, right? So it takes a lot of work. I probably have sat and done a rosary once in my life. That's a bad
guess. I'm sure there's better things to do.
Oh, wow. I didn't understand that. How does that work? So for each beams that you're doing,
there's a prayer.
Oh, right. Yeah. I didn't know that. Just learned something. There you go.
Anyway, as she worked her way through that Apostles' Creed, the guy from the back walked towards her. Maria said, "The next thing I know, he had turned very quick. Come to my rear and grab me around the head. He placed a small cloth over my mouth and I fell backward on the floor. I began to scream now as when I fell, the rag fell free from my mouth. Then while I was on the floor, he tried to cover my mouth with his hands to stop me from screaming. And when he did this, one of his fingers went into my mouth and I bit hard. I know I bit very hard because I could taste blood in my mouth. When I bit him, he threw me toward the south door of the church and ran out the north side door." So that is a pretty awful thing to have happen to you.
Google.
Do we suspect the cloth was chloroform?
No, I think it was just a gag. It was just to keep it quiet.
Okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do they use that in real life, do you reckon?
Yeah.
I think there's any movies. That's the first thing
I
thought.
We don't see enough chloroform.
I know we don't, because that was the first thing I thought when you said chloroform. When she pulled it, I was like, he's got chloroform. But no.
Yeah, that's
the thing about chloroform is it can kill people if you administer too much. So if you're just, wanting to use chloroform.
How do you sort of negate that? Do you just do better measurement? Do you actually, she's mindful of?
Yes.
Absolutely. Last time. Atma, the first time I did it.
not to be toyed with, That's right. Okay, so as poor old Maria 1 was being attacked, Maria 2, otherwise known as Maria Cristina Tijerna, Tijerna, I reckon, was walking past the church and heard screaming and then saw a man hurry away from the church. He was holding a white towel and he headed into the sacristy. Maria Guerra, Maria 1, ran out of the church and over to the rectory where she knocked on the door, and the resident priest, Reverend Charles Moran, called out, "Wait a minute," because he was actually taking a shower at the time. Maria Tierna asked Maria America, so two asked one, what had happened, and she relayed the story of her attack. Then Maria Tierna walked off, which I thought was pretty weird, but apparently she was late for work. Maria America, as in one, went home and reported the attack to the police. Yeah. There's quite a few Marias, that's it, yeah.
Mm-mm.
Okay, so now let me introduce you to Irene Garza. Irene was the stuff of legend in McAllen. Born in 1934 to parents Nick and Josephina, I'm not sure, Irene grew up in a loving household. Her parents owned a dry cleaning store, and over time it became successful enough that they could move to North McAllen, which was a nice neighbourhood and a step up from the south side. North Bondi versus the Junga.
Are we still in Edinburgh?
We're in McAllen, which isn't far from Edinburgh. But they're very close to each other, really. So it's a bit like, I don't really know if this is correct, but say, I'll use something that we both understand. Bondi to Ryde. No, that's the wrong side of town, isn't it? Bondi to...
Use something accurate that you both understand.
Rose Bay.
Not far. It's like,
Yeah. Yep.
5 days, 10 days.
I know, that's the other side. That's
Not
done. Stupid.
They're not far. Okay. They're not far at all. It's got
it. So Irene was physically beautiful, and by all accounts, even more beautiful on the inside. She and her cousin, I think, were the first Latina girls at the school to become part of the majorette team, and she actually became a drum majorette or twirler, which apparently was a big deal. Mm. And she was the first in her family to graduate school and go to college. She was bright and had a generous and caring nature. At college, she was Pan American College Queen and Miss All South Texas in 1958. She was also a devout Catholic and was active in the Legion of Mary. Wherever she went.
The Legion of Mary.
Is that like the...
Yeah, I know. I don't like the word legion because it reminds me of like Satanists and stuff. Yeah.
God, I was thinking about John Wayne Gacy. Was he the...
He was in the JCs.
The JCs,
yeah.
Was one of the superheroes Legion?
I think so.
Or did I make that up?
I'm not 100% sure. It sounds like a villain.
Yeah, it does sound
hordes,
like a villain.
The hordes of Satan are Legion. Hey, let's face it. Legion is used in a strange way. But this was the Legion of Mary, and Mary the Immaculate, I'm assuming, the Virgin Mary, so meant to be on the good side. So wherever she went, people noticed her. Men desired her. Some women were jealous of her, and all the little girls in the neighborhood idolized her. She always dressed beautifully and was beyond elegant. By 1960, Irene was 25 and working as a school teacher at an elementary school for the disadvantaged kids in the area, and used her first paycheck to buy books and stationery for some of her students. She had also been elected the secretary of the PTA and wrote to a friend, "This may not sound like much, but to me it means a great deal. It means I'm overcoming my terrible shyness and becoming surer of myself." I don't know if you can hear that. Of course, Tony chooses now to literally drill above me.
I've heard that.
Good. Okay.
It's the only chance he gets to hide the body.
He's cleaning up after Schmitty's dirty work.
Sure.
She's got him in the barrel.
And for our listeners, I can assure you, Tony never cleans anything, so that's not likely to happen. She loved her job, writing, "These children I'm teaching have become such a joy to me." She devoted her time to giving her students learning opportunities, keen to give them the chance to cross the lines as she had done with her own family. Underneath, though, she suffered a lack of confidence or some great humility where, on breaking up with her boyfriend, Sonny, she blamed herself for not being what he needed, which apparently was a busty and confident broad. It was her faith that helped her the most. Writing to a friend, "Remember the last time we talked? I told you I was afraid of death. Well, I think I'm cured. You see, I've been going to communion and mass daily, and you can't imagine the courage and faith and happiness it has given me."
That's nice.
Yeah. Apparently she went to confession quite regularly, and her family had a bit of an inside joke about that she really didn't actually have anything to confess. So it was like
anything
she was
to confess
she's
to.
Such an angel, right? You know, so good and actually, so lovely.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were, like, basically I think there was, as much as they were all quite devout, I think she was a bit of a God botherer. Anyway, on Saturday, April 16th, 1960, which happened to be Easter Saturday, Irene borrowed the family car to go to church, promising her mother she wouldn't be long. She had agreed to go to a movie with a friend of hers, but insisted on going to church first as she wanted to attend confession. She left her parents' house around 6:30 in the evening and drove to Sacred Heart Church, which is about 12 blocks away.
Did she do that overnight?
Because it was Easter. It would have had a lot of extra services on being Easter.
Okay.
Confession's quite standard, a standard Catholic rite around Easter.
Oh, okay. And it's used whenever, or is it like without
They usually
their
have sessions. They will give you sessions. Okay. They'll tell you when they're available to do it.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So it's not unusual. It's in the evening.
Shmira, did you ever confess to the chloroform incident?
No.
That we were talking about earlier?
I think, and, you know, bless me, Father, for I've sinned. It's been a very long time since I have confessed. I can tell you that a childhood confession I do recall making was when Rachel Davenport and I egged the neighbour's car. I'm pretty sure I confessed that to the priest. Yeah.
Well,
we'd already been massively told off, but, you know, I had to think about what am I going to say?
And what did the priest say?
Oh, go outside and do a couple of Hail Marys and now, Father, you're fine. Off you go. Which I did.
Asking for a friend.
It's all about actually being, you know, showing that you have contrition. So, yeah, as I said earlier, she's highly visible because she's so attractive, right? Remember, this is a Miss Texas South Side, Texas, or wherever it was. She's just stunning. She dresses beautifully in little pillbox hats, you know, the perfect 1950s, 60s outfits. Wow. Like, she's just gorgeous. And I've seen images of her. She's a just beautiful woman. And so, of course, she stands out. And so that night was no exception. The other parishioners waiting for confession saw her at the church. One saw her enter the sanctuary. Another saw her kneeling in a pew praying. Another witness reported that she'd asked to jump the queue as she was running late, probably thinking about getting to the movies. And she was seen heading to the rectory. But one thing no one saw that night was Irene leave. The next morning, Easter Sunday, her car was still parked near the church.
Did they see someone with hornbag glasses?
Well, yeah, they did. Yeah.
Is it the same church as the first church?
No, it's a different church. It's the same name church. They're both called the Sacred Heart. But this one's in McAllen and the other one's in Edinburgh.
Okay, got it.
Same MO.
He's got a thing for Catholic.
Her car was still there the next day and there was no sign of Irene. When Irene didn't come home that night, her family went out to look for her. Finally, the car still parked near the church and no sign of Irene, her father reported her missing. Initially, the police thought she might have run off with a new fella. She certainly had her pick of the young men of the area and many had shown an interest in her, but her family knew that wasn't right and they were deeply concerned, mostly because she didn't do things that she, like, she wasn't the kind of person who would have done that, you know, like, she always did what she said she was going to do. She said, if she said, I'm going to be home at 10, she'll be home at 10.
Might have been dragged off with a new fella.
Yeah, but that's the point, right? It wasn't, she has not gone of her own volition. They were quite clear on that.
Mm.
Now, it didn't take very long for investigators to link Irene's disappearance with the assault on Maria Guerra from 3 weeks earlier. And they started to dig further that case to try to identify the attacker. And to your point, Clarkie, you know, both happened around churches. If you look at photos of these women, they look very similar as well. So they would have thought, okay, there's something there. They spoke again to Maria and she told them again that her attacker was a white male with horn-rimmed glasses in a light tan shirt and dark trousers. Clothing, she assumed, was that of a priest.
Oh,
no.
I looked at this man and I said, I thought that he was the one who had attacked me. Later that night, I told my mother this was the man who attacked me.
What? Where did she see him?
She sees him in a letter.
Oh, okay.
She wrote a statement 2 weeks later, so this helps answer that too. I saw this same man not long after at the library at Pan America College. I keep wanting to call it Pan Am. Pan America College, but I saw
him. Jesus. Yeah. That's Pan Am. That's so funny.
Pan Am, I saw him dressed as a priest, and I was surprised to see him dressed as a priest, as this is the same man I'd seen at the police station in McAllen. The lineup. The minute I saw him, I felt afraid of him.
Jesus.
I want to state that this same priest that I have seen at the college and that I saw at the police station in McAllen is the same man who attacked me in church in Edinburgh. I am positive he is the same man. So that's the direct statement from Maria Guerra.
What?
Oh, God.
3 days after Irene disappeared, a pedestrian, actually quite a few passers-by, and now I'm editorialising with quite possibly a dog walker, found her high-heeled shoe, her purse and her mantilla on a farm road.
Well, they found her shoe,
yeah. I get your point, yeah. Then on Thursday, the 21st of April, Irene Garza's body was found floating face down in an irrigation canal. When the police went to the Garza home on the Friday, they broke the news of Irene's death. Her mother, Josephina, collapsed and cried out in such a way that no one ever forgot. Her niece described it. They said it was this long, awful moan from deep inside her body, almost like the howl of a wolf. They said it was like nothing they had ever heard or ever heard again. Sometime after 7:30 p.m. on Holy Saturday, someone had bludgeoned Irene, raped her while she was unconscious, and then suffocated her and threw her body into a canal on Easter Sunday. The autopsy report said evidence of strangulation could not be found, but suffocation could have been carried out by placing a cloth over the mouth and nose, especially if the subject was unconscious. When the police drained the canal, they found a candelabra or a candlestick, I heard it called two things, which is likely that it was used to bludgeon her. However, the police never bothered to match them to the head wounds. And a portable photographic slide viewer, it sounds really weird and this is an oldie-timey thing.
Yeah.
It almost looks like a razor. I don't know how to describe this. I'm guessing, I don't know, you must have looked in it, like, I don't know. It's hard to describe. But it's on a cord.
Oh, And you put
I think that's
take
a later version
out?
Of it, what you're talking about. You're talking that thing that you clicked over or, you know, like it's a slide view. It's a portable slide view.
But it used to be manually put them in and take them out.
Yeah, you're talking about the viewfinder. This was similar in that you would slip a slide into it, I think, but it had a cord on it, so it was powered, but it was portable in as much as it's smallish.
Yeah.
But it was a very heavy piece of equipment, as all photographic equipment was in the 60s. Yeah. They found this photographic slide viewer not far from where Irene's body was in the canal. They hypothesized that the cord of the slide viewer had been tied around her body and the heavy metal viewer was used to weigh the body down. Then on the 29th of April, the police received a note telling them who the owner of the viewer was.
The priest?
They interviewed the priest who had been giving confession on the Easter Saturday and noted that the last person to see Irene alive was a young priest who also happened to wear, you guessed it, horn-rimmed glasses and matched the description Maria had given.
Horn-rimmed glasses.
And even more of a coinkydink was the owner of the slide viewer. Whilst the police told the public that they had no leads, they very much suspected Father John Fite of the attack, and it didn't take a genius to further suspect him in the death of Irene.
He is the shittest priest.
Now, the Catholic leaders of the time didn't want any heat on a member of the clergy. There were tensions between Catholics and Protestants.
Oh, there we go. So they moved into another area.
So he's moved into Australia.
They feared very bad priests should the attacker turn out to be a priest.
Surprise, he's moved to Victoria.
They wanted this dealt with very quietly.
Ballarat.
After Irene's body was found, police spoke again with Fite's supervisor, Father Joseph O'Brien from Sacred Heart Church in McAllen, who had admitted that he also suspected something was off with John Fite. Fite had remarked on Easter Sunday that Irene had asked to receive confession at the rectory, which is very unusual. He also had been noted to have scratches all over his arms, which he said were caused when he went back to the pastoral house where he was living to get his glasses the night before.
Oh, so itchy.
He'd been locked out, so he had to climb in to get this thing and he scratched himself, climbing a wall, and that's how it happened. The scratches, however, did look very much like long fingernail scratches down his forearms.
Fingernails.
And they were literally all over the forearms. So O'Brien had been so suspicious that he and another priest actually searched the premises for Irene while she was disappeared. And he didn't find anything, but he couldn't shake the feeling that John Fite was involved. So who was John Fite? John was born in Chicago in 1933 to devout German Catholic parents. At age 13, John was sent to San Antonio to begin his religious education because the parents wanted him to become a priest. He became a priest in Texas in 1958 within the Order of Mary Immaculate. A year later, he began a one-year internship program based out of a pastoral house run by the Oblate Fathers in the valley town of San Juan, Texas. And that is where we find him.
So he's young, isn't he?
So he's
young?
25.
He's 27.
From that pastoral house, Fite and several other Order of Mary Immaculate priests took classes at nearby Pan American College and helped fill in at parishes in nearby McAllen and Edinburgh. Father Fite often helped Father Charles Moran at the Sacred Heart Church in Edinburgh. And if you recall, Charles Moran was the man who said, wait a minute, because he was in the shower when Maria I was attacked. And through the spring of 1960, he also often stopped by the rectory in Edinburgh for coffee with Father Moran and the church secretaries. Easter weekend of that year, Father Fite was asked to help Father Joseph O'Brien and his two associate priests give confession and offer Mass at Sacred Heart Church in McAllen. So he was absolutely at the church when Irene went missing. By his own account, on the day that Maria America Guerra was attacked, he had visited the Sacred Heart in Edinburgh and had been in the church praying until 5:15, but then he went to speak to the Reverend about a boy he knew who had been having some issues. He then left to go back to San Juan, which was just down the road, as he had to ring the bells there at 5:30 p.m. Now, I am making an assumption that the bells were at the Basilica of Our Lady of San Juan de Valles, and I think that the pastoral house he's living at was also there. Regardless of the fact that John said he had to ring the bells at 5:30, no one can recall the bells being rung that day. People noticed that Father Fite had a rather badly injured finger, though, and he claimed to have heard it working on a I'm a graph machine. And his own quote, in trying to make the stencil ink better, the little finger of my left hand caught between the revolving drum and the frame, breaking the skin and causing a severe bruise.
Hello, Maria's teeth.
He said he asked Father Houlihan for some rubbing alcohol for his injured finger, and he asked the Edinburgh Church secretary for a bandage. Now, according to him, all of these requests were the day before the Maria Guerrero attack.
Poor thing. He's just caught up in
according
this
to Father
unjustly.
Houlihan and the secretary involved, however, it was after the attack.
Someone's pants
the
are on fire.
The secretary apparently had asked how he hurt his finger, and he said, I heard it in the mimeograph machine. Now, a second secretary who was there at the time was a woman named Clotilde Sanchez, who went by the name of Tilly. Tilly seemed to notice a lot of details and recalled that Father Fite's finger had distinctive bite marks. I didn't just ask Fite what happened to his finger, she tells New Times. I asked, who bit your finger? It had teeth marks on it. It was clear as day. Fite said it isn't a bite. I said, well, it sure looks like a bite. You can see the mouth shape on it. Clotilde also recalled that not long, she's feisty, right? Not long after Irene was murdered, she received a phone call. She knew the voice on the phone, having spoken to him many times and noting his distinctive voice. She knew it was John Fite. But all the caller said was, you're next, Tilly.
You're next, Gov.
Really?
Fucking hell. How bad's this gone?
So, ballsy. As I said, the Catholic leaders wanted to keep this all quiet.
I'm just giving you the heads up, love.
Because he's got God on his side.
Oh, I was going to say, a bit confident, mate. Wouldn't you just keep it under your hat and go about your business? Oh, no, I'll give her a heads up. You're next, Tilly.
The other way it was said was, Tilly, you're next, honey. So I've read two versions of that quote. And I think the second one's more disturbing, calling her honey. Tilly, you're next, honey. All right. And as I said, the Catholic leaders wanted to keep this quiet. So shortly after Irene was found, they sent John Fite to Chicago, where he was given a series of polygraph tests to determine whether or not he was involved. Now, we know polygraphs are not admissible in court and can be faked, but the examiner was pretty sure the results were conclusive. A lengthy report detailing the exams by Texas authorities, then by a guy called John Reed, who apparently was the top polygraph examiner in the country at the time, and it does make for interesting reading. The tests, and this is the quote, definitely implicated him in both crimes. It is the opinion of the examiner, based on the subject's polygraph test, that Fite is purposely attempting to defeat the recordings. Okay, so let's remember what we're trusting here. Yeah. In fact, each time Fite was hooked up to a polygraph machine, he began taking exactly 10 breaths per minute, indicating that he was purposely controlling his breathing, even though he had been given warnings and instructions throughout. Examiners monitored Fite's breathing rate during other conversations when he didn't know that he was actually being monitored, and they said he inhaled and exhaled 16 to 20 times a minute. This guy went on to describe Fite's demeanor during the test. The examiner pointed out in detail to the subject that he should make an effort to tell the truth concerning his implication in these crimes so that the church and the priesthood would not suffer when evidence definitely implicating him has turned up at a later date. There's nothing like, you know, presumption of innocence until proven guilty.
The subject,
in very deliberate and explicit words, stated there will never be any evidence turning up in the future of this case. He also pointed out to the examiner that there were two murders in the area that had gone unsolved, one for 15 and one for 20 years, and that this case, like those, will soon be forgotten. When asked about the attack on Maria America Guerra, not very nice, his answers bordered on the absurd. At one point, he claimed that Guerra's true attacker had actually confessed to him. The subject was queried as to where the confession was obtained, and Fite told the examiner that it was not in the confessional box, not in the rectory, but out in the open someplace, and was very vague as to where the open place was. Oh, you know, somewhere out there. When asked if the lie detector was incorrect when it indicated that he committed these crimes, and again, I haven't got the full transcript of this examination, but I don't think he indicated he committed the crimes. He answered, your machine is probably functioning correctly, but these men from Austin have told me that I have a vague respiration and a bad heart. In effect, the stated belief by examiners was that John Fite was concealing the truth, and it wouldn't mean anything in a courtroom. It only proved that he was gaming the test, not that he had killed Irene or attacked Maria, but it does imply that he might have been trying to hide something. On May the 3rd of 1960, 2 weeks after Irene Garza disappeared, police asked Fite to give a sworn statement of his whereabouts on Easter weekend. And I'm about to take you through that. So at 7 p.m. on the Saturday before Easter, he told the police that he and Father O'Brien were leaving the rectory, heading for the church, when the phone rang and he went back in to answer it.
Ben.
He said a woman was on the line asking to see Father Junius, who was already taking confessions in the church. Now, he told the woman that Father Junius would be busy until 10:30 p.m., but if she hurried over down to the church, he could talk to her himself. Irene Garza arrived 5 minutes later. She was a light-complexioned girl, apparently of Latin American extraction, good-looking. She spoke perfect English. For 10 minutes, she discussed a personal problem of hers with me, the nature of which I do not feel justified in making public, since it involved my obligation of professional secrecy as a clergyman and Catholic priest. However, he did let on that he didn't think the issue was actually too serious. But then in later, later statements, he talks about being so upset by the confession that he got all hot and sweaty and he had to drive around and he was sweating so much he had to go back to his pastoral place, house, and get a change of clothes. And, of course, that was when he got locked out. He had to climb up the wall and, you know, all that shit.
Scratch his arms. Yeah.
He's had a really bad day.
He did have a pretty bad day anyway. But at this occasion anyway, he's saying that it was not her confession wasn't really a big deal. Then he sent her off to the church to go to confession, which I also don't understand because if he actually gave her confession in the rectory, why is he sending her off to confession in the church? Or perhaps it wasn't a confession, she was just talking about some issue she had. Now, at the time, there were about 200 people attending for the Easter confession. And as I said earlier, if it sounds like sinners abound in McAllen with 200 people lining up to tell the priest what they'd done wrong, it's not really that. It's the standard Catholic rite at Easter. So it's pretty normal for the church to be full of confessors. My favourite confession, just as a segue.
It's a shame.
I don't know if they always did this. When I was a kid, you used to have to go into the little booth and you bless me, Father, for I've sinned, and go through the whole kind of rite of confession. But then later, they brought out like these mass confessions. It was like a mass, and then they just sort of said, okay, bow your head and think about what you did badly, and okay, now you're all forgiven. And I was like, that has got to be the best confessing ever. You didn't even have to say it out loud.
Put your hand up if you've done this one.
Like, great. So easy. Yeah.
I got visions of the Pope coming out.
I think it's just we can't be fucked hanging around for hours while you all line up to bloody tell us that you egged your neighbour's car.
Yeah, right. Don't got time for this. Yeah.
We'll all sort of, if you know that everybody else is doing it, it's all
camaraderie.
Give me one of those. My God. What about your fuck-up, sweetheart? Whoopsie-daisy. Never mind. I could imagine that they do all the, murdered someone.
It's not actually that. I'm sorry, you've got the wrong impression. It's not like here's a list of sins, rank from 1 to 10, which one you've done in whatever order.
10.
Or 1 to 100, whatever it is. It's more just quietly reflect on what you've done wrong and be contrite and then you get forgiven.
You don't even have to confess.
Just
bow your head.
I know, it's great.
It's not confession. That's...
Anyway, he then said he left the rectory, locked the door behind him, headed to the church to help the other three priests give confession.
Hang on, Schmitty, sorry to interrupt, but how many times are you going to say rectory?
The rectory is really important.
I don't even know what a rectory is. I'm assuming it's around the back.
It's the building around the back that the priests hang out in when they're not in the, really in the official church, right?
Is it like a
pretty much? Yeah.
I bet
the priests hang important, out the back.
Clarkies, you don't give confession in a rectory. So it's like or a presbytery. You don't go to the... You don't.
Commit sin
you
in
might
the
go
rectory,
to the priest's house to have a chat with him or do some office business, but you don't do something that is a rite, which is confession or marriage or funeral rites or last rites, all those sort of things. You don't do them in a rectory usually. You do that in the church. Anyway, so he then says he last saw Irene standing on the sidewalk in front of the church, arranging a scarf or a handkerchief on her head. Now, other witnesses had said that they'd seen her in various places in the church, but she had a lace veil that she pulled over her face when she went to do the confession. Irene, she's so chic.
Yes, I know.
God. You know, so she's got Oh, God. Anyway, so she had this beautiful thing and, oh, she's just perfect. At 8 p.m., Fite said he left the church for a short break. He saw Father O'Brien chatting with some other men outside the church. Then he went and got the keys to the rectory off Father O'Brien. But from this,
is it directory?
Like, just because it sounds a bit like rectum that you're so bothered by it.
Correct. No, I'm not bothered. That's just making bad pun jokes. But, all right. You know, you were very serious with your explanation, and so I just let it go. But thank you.
You're welcome. Come into now, at this point, his story changes direction from what other witnesses saw. He then said he returned to the church at about 8:15 and then he left again at 9 to go to the rectory because his voice was giving out. And there he had a cigarette and a 7-Up and returned to the church to give more confessions. However, a load of what I'm going to say probably pretty pissed off Catholics definitely noticed that his confession box line didn't move after 8 p.m. as there didn't appear to be a priest in there. And I can tell you, if you've been queuing up for hours.
Oh, you'd be
shitty.
And then
the priest scarpers off for a durry and a 7-Up and doesn't come back. You'd be like, oh, come off it. Yeah.
Oh, it's like back in the day when banks used to have separate lines.
In the
and
wrong
you'd
one.
Get stuck. So everyone would join and join money. Oh, this is the same money. And then the person in front would spend half an hour. Again. And you're like, oh, come on. I reckon that's what they were all doing. Are you kidding me? How many sins? Give someone else
a go, mate. Schmitty's in there again. She takes her time. She's got so many sins.
She's just talking about soap. It's not even a crime.
Then he, part of his story is he's got this thing about the screw in his glasses fell out around 10 to 10. And so he told Father Bush that he had to go to the pastoral house to get his others. So he's, again, making excuses why he's going back to pastoral house. So now it's glasses and not sweaty clothes and having it going back to the pastoral house. So in his other statement, he said he was all head up and now this time it's, no, I had to get new glasses. Then the next day, Father O'Brien and the other priest did note that he had scratches up his arm, but he explained it by saying, upon arriving at the pastoral house in San Juan, I found all the doors on the ground floor locked. So he said he placed a wood barricade against the building and climbed up and through a second-story window. While entering the house this way, I scraped the back of my right hand slightly and the index finger and middle finger of my left hand more severely on the brick wall. He then said he changed his clothes, which is weird because he just went for his glasses, and headed back to McAllen for the 11 p.m. service because this is a long Easter. He then said he went to bed about 1 a.m. with a severe headache, which he assumed was caused by his second pair of glasses. He said of the spectacles, they never fit me as well as the first pair. The next morning, Fite gave Mass at 9 a.m. and then asked Fathers Bush and O'Brien if he could use Bush's car to go to San Juan and get his glasses fixed. He said he worked on the glasses for 5 minutes but had no luck. Then he said, I drove straight back to Sacred Heart Church. So I don't know who's working on the glasses because he's driving around looking for someone to fit and fix them. At 12:40 p.m., he asked another priest to drive him back to the pastoral house in San Juan where he stayed until about 4 p.m. He then returned to Sacred Heart to give Mass at 5:30. Shortly after 7:30 p.m. on Easter Sunday, he said he was given a ride back to the pastoral house by Father O'Brien. He said he immediately realised he'd left some of his belongings at Sacred Heart, so he then borrowed another car and drove back to the church. There, he said, several priests were talking about the missing girl. As he stood there, the phone rang. Father Junius answered. It was Irene Garza's parents wanting to speak with the priest who had spoken to her the night before. The parents came over and Fite said he spoke with them. He said they asked him if he had perhaps said anything which might have upset or disturbed their daughter. In fact, Nick Garza asked him, what have you done with my daughter?
Oh.
Schmitty, can I ask, how long after the event was this interview, this confession, that his recollection of
this would
events?
Be a week or two because it takes them a while to connect him and get a statement out of him.
Because there's a lot of detail. Yeah. I'm not very good at remembering what I did yesterday. But he remembers.
Also, so do a lot of other witnesses, though.
Well, so
a lot of people
on.
Seem to remember this. And I wonder whether or not if you have a traumatic thing happen, like someone being murdered on your doorstep, that you are more likely to remember. Because I think about this all the time when we do these stories. And later on, he's asked to talk about something from decades ago. It's like
he made a paper.
That's why she's got such a good memory.
Well, I don't have a good memory.
Absolutely,
I don't have a good memory. Like you,
it really helped me. Oh.
I can barely remember what I did yesterday or what I had for dinner. How you would say 10 years ago, this is where I was, this is what happened, this is the conversation, is beyond me.
Yeah.
Unless it's with the trauma of being, because I'm sure if you're asked straight up, you're racking your brains to remember stuff, and then it sort of becomes a story you tell yourself.
Yeah, I think that's right, yeah.
He could see that the parents were quite upset, and so he sent them home as quick and quietly as possible. He then picked up his coat, collar and laundry and headed back to home, which is that pastoral house. It's about 9:15 p.m. But I didn't go straight home. My talk with the girl's parents had disturbed me. Perhaps I had said something unintentionally that might have upset that girl. I was worried and I drove around aimlessly for a while. He said he stopped at a nearby food shop, got a malt and then drove back to San Juan in time for the 10 o'clock news. So he's driving around for 45 minutes. According to him. Now, according to the investigators, Irene's body was probably thrown into the canal on Easter Sunday evening.
Ooh. Well, can't be. He was driving me around wondering if he's somehow, upset her with his response to that confession.
No, of course. After Easter, Fight was attending an audiovisual aid class at the Pan American College in Edinburgh, where a classmate, Jose Garcia, was sitting next to him. Jose noticed he had obvious and fresh scratches on his hands, which made Jose a little suspicious, given he'd also just heard of the disappearance of Irene. He said, "They looked like fingernail scratches." Whilst he may have noticed this, he did not report it or come forward at that time. So, as it turns out, Fight was interviewed by the police about the murder for about 12 hours. At that time, he confidently told them that they would never convict him of anything. The officer also went to the Sacred Heart Church to look at the parish car, and apparently it had just been washed inside and out because there was blood on the seat. And I cannot find any reference to that anywhere. So I don't know how they know there was blood on the seat and that's why it was washed inside and out.
Yeah, right.
And there is a little bit of that in this case where statements are made as fact that may not be.
What worries me is at the start you said that this is the longest cold case.
I don't know if it is the oldest. It's one of the oldest cold cases.
So what's annoying me is that he's going to get off.
Not long after the murder, our mate John was sent off. And here we go. Going back to what you said earlier about what happens when the Catholic Church wants to keep things quiet. John was sent off to study at Loyola University in Chicago.
It's textbook Catholic Church, isn't it?
Whilst investigators were very sus on him, they were also struggling to believe that a priest could commit a murder. So it's 1960s, right? Priests was considered so pious that they were above reproach.
Yeah.
It was literally unthinkable that a man of God could commit the ultimate sin. It's just unthinkable. So, the case is stymied, the guy's disappeared, but he couldn't have killed. He couldn't have killed. It can't be him. Attempted rape, however, was another matter. The Hidalgo County Grand Jury on August 10, 1961, indicted Fight on charges of assault with attempt to rape in connection with the attack on Maria Guerra at the Sacred Heart Church in Edinburgh, on the 23rd of May. So the first attack I spoke of. After he was indicted for attempted rape, he said he wasn't bitter. Priests must expect persecution. Christ told the apostles, "Know that of the world hates you, it also hated me." After disappearing for several weeks.
What?
Oh, everyone's going to hate Christians. They hated me. They're going to hate you. You're going to be persecuted. Just deal with it.
Oh, so he's trying to make himself like everyone else.
Like a martyr who's following. This is what happens, when you're the righteous.
Yeah.
So, after disappearing for several weeks to an unspecified out-of-state hospital, he surrendered to police. Fight had the venue. The venue of his court case transferred to Austin. As being number one suspect in a rape and a murder case, I doubt a fair trial would have been expected, so that's fair enough. And he was tried on the 12th of September, 1961.
Mm-hmm.
The jury deadlocked at
I thought you'd just go like 45 minutes down the road.
Austin's quite a bit further. But it's the 60s too. So what was local news might not have made it to Austin.
Yeah,
as a Catholic. No. Is it 45? Ballarat. Yeah, I suppose. 45 minutes down the road.
Well, no. Remember the camouflage assassin in St. Tammany Parish, and he went.
Oh, no, he's just round the corner. It's ridiculous. Because they wanted to fit him up.
Yeah, that's right.
Also, he wasn't a white priest in the 60s. Yeah.
Yeah, correct. All those things.
The jury did deadlock, though, and the judge declared a mistrial. So in 1962, when we have a new trial for this, Fite pled no contest to a reduced charge of aggravated assault and was fined $500.
What? You are kidding.
I don't understand that. I actually don't. So I don't understand any of it. I mean, don't see what happened what happened from the first one?
Well, the jury couldn't come to an agreement and the judge called a mistrial, right?
Well, why couldn't they? Didn't he say that he'd done it?
Well, I think, no, he didn't confess to it. So Maria 1 and Maria 2 alleged to have seen a man fitting his description. Well, Maria 1 says he attacked her.
Okay, so that's what we're dealing with. Right, okay.
Some people may or may not have seen that he had a bite mark. And so that woman, Clotilde Sanchez, did testify at the rape case.
Killing it,
But a couple of, like, I don't have a great deal of information on that trial. In fact, I have none. I did read somewhere else that there were obviously defence witnesses and probably character defence witnesses coming forward saying how lovely he was and how he'd never do anything wrong. So if you think of it in the context, not the story I've told you where I've predisposed you to be biased, but if you think about it in the context of what would have been presented to the jury at the time, it's quite possible that they said it's not beyond reasonable doubt that this did or didn't happen, and we can't agree.
Particularly if they've got blind faith.
And he's a priest, right?
Yeah.
So, having been fined $500, he was asked if he had anything to say. He said, no, nothing.
Jeez, I got off the line there, didn't I?
Got nothing to say.
$500 was a lot in those days.
It would have been
I'm just going to go and put a lottery ticket on.
Yeah.
Oh, God. The church probably paid his fine too. Ugh.
Probably, yeah. He even said that he had no idea what he was pleading to in court, though by all accounts he was a highly intelligent person and would have known absolutely what was going on. Irene Garza's parents thought that the police were doing a pretty shit-ass job, and they confronted both priests.
I'm with them.
They actually confronted Joseph O'Brien and John Fite, and O'Brien assured them that if Fite had done anything wrong, the church would punish him and...
It's comedy night tonight. Here on mine.
Church punishment was greater than any sentence he would receive in court.
Stop it.
At any rate, the investigation into Irene's murder seemed to go cold at this time. Some have said that they felt that any attempt to continue to look into it were discouraged. Almost as if the authorities and the church just wanted it dropped.
Deleted.
And it was.
Wow, no way. Wow, was it? Far out.
So what I'm going to do, guys, is because I still got, there was a lot in this case, a lot. And as much as it's gone cold at this point in time in circa 1962, as I said at the beginning, this is a really long cold case, right, that gets solved. So we want to find out what happens in the intervening 50-something years. There's a clue there.
Oh.
He changes his name to George Pell and moves to Ballarat?
Then he has a hip replacement and God's punishment was greater than any sentence he would receive in court. Maybe. Do you guys have any comments or anything that you kind of that struck you in that before we finish up and come back to it another time? Thoughts?
So, all as per stereotype so far.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you've preempted absolutely everything. It's like, and then they just moved him. And then,
shitty priest commits crime, gets moved, gets off, fucking blah, blah, blah.
Poor parents. Oh, God.
Isn't it horrendous? Yeah, it's absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
Oh. I hope that the higher punishment is actually worse than the court punishment. I mean, I don't believe in that stuff, so I'm sure it's not, but I just wish it was.
What I will tell you, though, about Father O'Brien is that he had absolute suspicions at all times about John Fite. And when he went to see the parents, and this is a little to talk about, you know, to express his condolences, I think, and console them over Irene's death, he said to them that something along the lines of that she died in a state of grace because she had literally just confessed. So she'd had a confession. So, you know, basically from a Catholic perspective, if you're going to die, it's almost as good as having your last rites, right? The question is, did she? Because we don't even know if her confession was ever heard. Not that it matters, because she was an absolute saint and an angel anyway. So, frankly, she didn't really have anything to confess for, I'm sure. But it was, for me, I don't know, I just find that kind of cold comfort for someone. If someone had said that to me about my daughter being killed, I think I would have punched him in the face. And that's coming from a Catholic position. I'm a modern Catholic. I'm absolutely a modern Catholic. And I'm not, it's culturally different, right? So I don't have.
Directory.
It's different. It's like being an Irish Catholic, right? Like in Ireland. They're very different. My experience of Catholicism in Australia is much more open. It's not down the lay of the land. Yeah. Like, you know, Irish Catholicism that I experienced in the UK was much more like probably 1960s Texas Catholicism, you know, much more rigid.
Yeah.
Mind you, thinking about that, some of the things that our parish priest said to me when Mum was dying and then died, I mean, fortunately I've got a good sense of humour, but there were times where I just thought, what? Anyway. Oh, you know, I'm sorry, because I tried to get him to do Mum's last rites for about a week. She went into hospital on a Monday. She died almost 2 weeks later on a Friday. I spent that whole time trying to get that priest to go, and he said, oh, I was there, but I got caught on the freeway, so I turned around. The traffic was too bad. Oh! And I was like, I have told you repeatedly that my mother's dying. Dying. Not with us much longer at all. Could you please go and give her the last rites? As it turns out, some other priest who was very nice came and did it off the morning, I think, that she passed or, somewhere, I don't know, in that last 24 to 48 hours. But she wasn't conscious. And the whole idea, it would have been comforting to her had she been conscious and known that had happened. Anyway, that's a little bit of a tangent, but they get it wrong. Point is, if you really are like ordained by God and somehow special, you need to do better. Anyway,
You shit blokes.
Yeah. Anyway, all right.
Shit blokes with bad senses and stupid morals.
That's not their fault. They're told to dress that shit that way. Okay. Any other thoughts? Or I will leave it there for part two where we find out what happens next.
Okay.
Can't wait.
All right. Well, thanks for that. And as we say every week.
Ciao, ciao.
We're sure ready. Ciao, ciao. Ciao.
Ta-da.
God bless you, everyone. Thanks for listening to Trial by Wine. You can contact us at trialbywine@gmail.com. Please rate, review, and subscribe to Trial by Wine on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to support us, you can become a patron at www.patreon.com/trialbywine or visit our website www.trialbywine.com to donate to us. Your support will help us cover many more cases and apply wacky sentences. We really appreciate you listening and hope you tell everyone about us. Our cover art is by John Christo and music is by Beauchamp from Pixabay.com.